something like a random wiggle drawn on a page. But now look at this wiggle through a net. The net has cut the big wiggle into little wiggles, all contained in squares of the same size. Order has been imposed on chaos. We can now say that the wiggle goes so many squares to the left, so many to the right, so many up or so many down, and at last we have its number. Centuries later, the same image of the net was imposed upon the world, as the lines of both celestial and terrestrial latitude and longitude, as graph paper for plotting mathematical wiggles, as pigeonholes for filing, and as the ground plan for cities. The net has thus become one of the presiding images of human thought. But it is always an image, and just as no one can use the equator to tie up a package, the real wiggly world slips like water through our imaginary nets. However much we divide, count, sort, or classify this wiggling into particular things and events, this is no more than a way of thinking about the world. It is never actually divided. Another powerful image is the ceramic model of the universe, in which we think of it as so many forms of one or more substances, as pots are forms of clay, and as God is said to have created Adam from the dust. This has been an especially troublesome image, bewildering philosophers and scientists for centuries, with such idiotic questions as, how does form, or energy, influence matter? What is matter? What happens to form, the soul, when it leaves matter, the body? How is it that mere matter has come to be arranged in orderly forms? What is the relationship between mind and body? Problems that remain persistently insoluble should always be suspected as questions asked in the wrong way, like the problem of cause and effect. Make a spurious division of one process into two, forget that you have done it, and then puzzle for centuries as to how the two get together. So with form and matter. Because no one ever discovered a piece of formless matter or an immaterial form, it should have been obvious that there was something wrong with the ceramic model. The world is no more formed out of matter than trees are made of wood. The world is neither form nor matter, for these are two clumsy terms for the same process, known vaguely as the world, or existence. Yet the illusion that every form consists of, or is made of, some kind of basic stuff, is deeply embedded in our common sense. We have quite forgotten that both matter and meter are alike derived from the Sanskrit root mater, to measure, and that the material world means no more than the world as measured or measurable, by such abstract images as nets or matrices, inches, seconds, grams, and decibels. The term material is often used as a synonym for the word physical, from the Greek physis, nature, and the original Indo-European beul, to become. There is nothing in the words to suggest that the material or physical world is made of any kind of stuff, according to the ceramic model, which must henceforth be called the crackpot model. But the crackpot model of the world, as formed of clay, has troubled more than the philosophers and the scientists. It lies at the root of the two major myths which have dominated Western civilization, and these, one following upon the other, have played an essential part in forming the illusion of the real person. If the world is basically mere stuff, like clay, it is hard to imagine that such inert dough can move and form itself. Energy, form, and intelligence must therefore come into the world from outside. The lump must be leavened. The world is therefore conceived as an artifact, like a jar, a statue, a table, or a bell. And if it is an artifact, someone must have made it, and someone must also have been responsible for the original stuff. That, too, must have been made. In Genesis, the primordial stuff, without form and void, is symbolized as water. And, as water does not wave without wind, nothing can happen until the Spirit of God moves upon its face. The forming and moving of matter is thus attributed to intelligent spirit, to a conscious force or energy informing matter, so that its various shapes come and go, live and die. Yet in the world as we now know it, many things are clearly wrong, and one hesitates to attribute these to the astonishing mind capable of making this world in the beginning. We are loath to believe that cruelty, pain, and malice come directly from the root and ground of being and hope fervently that God, at least, is the perfection of all that we can imagine as wisdom and justice. We need not enter here into the fabulous and insoluble problem of evil which this model of the universe creates, save to note that it arises from the model itself. The peoples who developed this myth were ruled by patriarchs or kings, and such superkings as the Egyptian, Chaldean, and Persian monarchs suggested the image of God as the monarch of the universe, perfect in wisdom and justice, love and mercy, yet nonetheless stern and exacting. I am not, of course, speaking of God as conceived by the most subtle Jewish, Christian, and Islamic theologians, but of the popular image. For it is the vivid image, rather than the tenuous concept, which has the greater influence on common sense. The image of God as a personal being, somehow outside or other than the world, had the merit of letting us feel that life is based on intelligence, that the laws of nature are everywhere consistent, and that they proceed from one ruler, and that we could let our imaginations go to the limit in conceiving the sublime qualities of this supreme and perfect being. The image also gave everyone a sense of importance and meaning, for this God is directly aware of every tiniest fragment of dust and vibration of energy, since it is just his awareness of it that enables it to be. This awareness is also love, and for angels and men at least, he has planned an everlasting life of the purest bliss, which is to begin at the end of mortal time. But of course, there are strings attached to this reward, and those who purposely and relentlessly deny or disobey the divine will must spend eternity in agonies as intense as the bliss of good and faithful subjects. The problem of this image of God was that it became too much of a good thing. Children working at their desks in school are almost always put off when even a kindly and respected teacher watches over their shoulders. How much more disconcerting to realize that each single deed, thought, and feeling is watched by the teacher of teachers, that nowhere on earth or in heaven is there any hiding place from the eye which sees all and judges all. To many people, it was therefore an immense relief when Western thinkers began to question this image and to assert that the hypothesis of God was of no help in describing or predicting the course of nature. If everything, they said, was the creation and the operation of God, the statement had no more logic than everything is up. But, as so often happens, when one tyrant is dethroned, a worse takes his place. The crackpot myth was retained without the potter. The world was still understood as an artifact, but on the model of an automatic machine. The laws of nature were still there, but no lawmaker. According to the deists, the Lord had made this machine and set it going, but then went to sleep or off on a vacation. But according to the atheists, naturalists, and agnostics, the world was fully automatic. It had constructed itself, though not on purpose. The stuff of matter was supposed to consist of atoms like minute billiard balls, so small as to permit no further division or analysis. Allow these atoms to wiggle around in various permutations and combinations for an indefinitely long time, and at some time, in virtually infinite time, they will fall into the arrangement that we now have as the world. The old story of the monkeys and typewriters. In this fully automatic model of the universe, shape and stuff survived as energy and matter. Human beings, mind and body included, were parts of the system, and thus they were possessed of intelligence and feeling as a consequence of the same interminable gyrations of atoms. But the trouble about the monkeys with typewriters is that when at last they get around to typing the Encyclopedia Britannica, they may at any moment relapse into gibberish. Therefore, if human beings want to maintain their fluky status and order, they must work with full fury to defeat the merely random processes of nature. It is most strongly emphasized in this myth that matter is brute and energy blind, that all nature outside human and some animal skins is a profoundly stupid and insensitive mechanism. Those who continued to believe in someone up there who cares were ridiculed as woolly-minded wishful thinkers, poor weaklings unable to face man's grim predicament in a heartless universe where survival is the sole privilege of the tough guys. If the all-too-intelligent God was disconcerting, relief in getting rid of him was short-lived. He was replaced by the cosmic idiot, and people began to feel more estranged from the universe than ever. This situation merely reinforced the illusion of the loneliness and separateness of the ego, now a mental mechanism, and people calling themselves naturalists began the biggest war on nature ever waged. In one form or another, the myth of the fully automatic model has become extremely plausible, and in some scientific and academic disciplines, it is as much a sacrosanct dogma as any theological doctrine of the past, despite contrary trends in physics and biology. For there are fashions in myth, and the world conquering West of the 19th century needed a philosophy of life in which realpolitik, victory for the tough people who faced the bleak facts, was the guiding principle. Thus, the bleaker the facts you face, the tougher you seem to be. So we vied with each other to make the fully automatic model of the universe as bleak as possible. Nevertheless, it remains a myth, with all the positive and negative features of myth as an image used for making sense of the world. It is doubtful whether Western science and technology would have been possible unless we had tried to understand nature in terms of mechanical models. According to Joseph Needham, the Chinese, despite all their sophistication, made little progress in science because it never occurred to them to think of nature as mechanism, as composed of separable parts and obeying logical laws. Their view of the universe was organic. It was not a game of billiards in which the balls knocked each other around in a cause and effect series. What were causes and effects to us were to them correlatives, events that arose mutually, like back and front. The parts of their universe were not separable, but as fully interwoven as the act of selling with the act of buying. Until the middle of the 17th century, Chinese and European scientific theories were about on a par, and only thereafter did European thought begin to move ahead so rapidly. But though it marched under the banner of Cartesian Newtonian mechanicism, that viewpoint could not permanently suffice for the needs of science. The time came when it was imperative to look upon physics as the study of the smaller organisms, and biology as the study of the larger organisms. When the time came, Europe, or rather by then the world, was able to draw up a mode of thinking very old, very wise, and not characteristically European at all. Needham, Science and Civilization in China. A made universe, whether of the crackpot or fully automatic model, is made of bits, and the bits are the basic realities of nature. Nature is therefore to be understood by microscopy and analysis, to find out what the bits are and how they are put together. This was the view of the nominalist philosophers of the late Middle Ages, who strongly opposed the then-called realists for maintaining that such entities as mankind or human nature were real substances underlying the accidents of particular men and women. Every individual was therefore an example or case of the human substance, though the word as then used did not mean matter or stuff, but a kind of essence, standing, stance, under, sub, its particular manifestations. The nominalists maintained that this was nonsense. For them, mankind was no more than the sum total of individual people. Mankind was not a substance, but simply a name for a class of creatures. It was not real, but merely nominal. Nominalism, as we know, became the dominant attitude of Western thought, and especially of the philosophy of science. In the 18th century, Rousseau went so far as to suggest that society and the state had originally been formed by a contract between individuals. Society was an association, like the Rotary Club, which individuals had at some time joined and thereby abandoned their original independence. But from the standpoint of modern sociology, we feel that man is necessarily a social thing, if only for the reason that no individual can come into being without a father and a mother. And this is already society. Until quite recent times, it has been the prevailing view of Western science that animals and plants, rocks and gases, are composed of such units as molecules, cells, atoms, and other particles, in much the same way that a house is composed of bricks. But a consistent nominalist will have to be forced into the position that there really is no such thing as the human body. There are only the particular molecules of which it is composed, or only the particular atoms, not to mention electrons, protons, neutrons, and so forth. Obviously, these particles do not by themselves constitute the human body. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts, if only for the fact that a scientific description of the body must take account of the order or pattern in which the particles are arranged and of what they are doing. The man behind the microscope has this advice for you. Instead of asking what it is, just ask, what does it do? But even this is not enough. We must also ask, in what surroundings is it doing it? If a description of the human body must include the description of what it and all its parts are doing, that is, of its behavior, this behavior will be one thing in the open air, but quite another in a vacuum, in a furnace, or underwater. Blood in a test tube is not the same thing as blood in the veins, because it is not behaving in the same way. Its behavior has changed because its environment or context has changed, just as the meaning of one and the same word may change according to the kind of sentence in which it is used. There is a vast difference between the bark of a tree and the bark of a dog. It is not enough, therefore, to describe, define, and try to understand things or events by analysis alone, by taking them to pieces to find out how they are made. This tells us much, but probably rather less than half the story. Today, scientists are more and more aware that what things are and what they are doing depends on where and when they are doing it. If, then, the definition of a thing or event must include definition of its environment, we realize that any given thing goes with a given environment so intimately and inseparably that it is more difficult to draw a clear boundary between the thing and its surroundings. This was the grain of truth in the primitive and unreliable science of astrology, as there were also grains of truth in alchemy, herbal medicine, and other primitive sciences. For when the astrologer draws a picture of a person's character or soul, he draws a horoscope, that is, a very rough and incomplete picture of the whole universe as it stood at the moment of that person's birth. But this is, at the same time, a vivid way of saying that your soul, or rather your essential self, is the whole cosmos as it is centered around the particular time, place, and activity called John Doe. Thus, the soul is not in the body, but the body in the soul. And the soul is the entire network of relationships and processes which make up your environment, and apart from which, you are nothing. A scientific astrology, if it could ever be worked out, would have to be a thorough description of the individual's total environment, social, biological, botanical, meteorological, and astronomical, throughout every moment of his life. But as things are, we define, and so come to feel, the individual in the light of our narrowed spotlight consciousness, which largely ignores the field or environment in which he is found. Individual is the Latin form of the Greek atom, that which cannot be cut or divided any further into separate parts. We cannot chop off a person's head or remove his heart without killing him, but we can kill him just as effectively by separating him from his proper environment. This implies that the only true atom is the universe, that total system of interdependent thing events which can be separated from each other only in name. For the human individual is not built as a car is built. He does not come into being by assembling parts, by screwing a head onto a neck, by wiring a brain to a set of lungs, or by welding veins to a heart. Head, neck, heart, lungs, brain, veins, muscles, and glands are separate names, but not separate events, and these events grow into being simultaneously and interdependently. In precisely the same way, the individual is separate from his universal environment only in name. When this is not recognized, you have been fooled by your name. Confusing names with nature, you come to believe that having a separate name